Welcome to Outside the Lines, the podcast of our host, Bob Cheviar. Bob is a longtime teaching pro in Westchester County, New York, and a former top 15 ranked player in the United States in the men's 35 and 40 and over singles and doubles in the late 1980s and early 90s. He is also the author of the pathbreaking book, Deconstructing Tennis, The 4D System. The book lays out a simple and complete framework for how to use the time between points in tennis. Bob's co-host on Outside the Lines is Scott Shannon, also a teaching pro in Westchester, whose best ranking in men's open singles was number two in the East in 1980. He was also ranked number one in the East that year in doubles with Peter Bromley. Scott was also a top 10 player in the U.S. in 35 and over singles and doubles. Your hosts hope to help you get your mental approach more on target.
Welcome to Outside the Lines. I'm your host, Bob Cheviar, and I'm here with my co-host, Scott Shannon. And today we're going to speak with you about playing to the score. Good tennis players, certainly the pros, all know how to adjust their level of risk. And they do that because some points in tennis are worth more than others. Tennis is particularly interesting because of its scoring system, where points occur in layers. In other words, points lead to a game, games lead to a set, and winning sets leads to winning a match. So understanding at what points there's more or less pressure is crucial. I think all of you understand if I said to you, you can take a point anytime you want in either of these two situations, the first point of the match or at five all deuce, you'd instinctively say five all deuce. Or if I said to you, you could take the first game of the match and claim it, or you could claim the game at five all if you chose to. But once again, the choice is pretty straightforward. But those simple examples illustrate the importance of the points changes quite a bit during a tennis match. Scott's going to talk a little bit more now about a system that he grew up with that describes this situation.
Thanks, Bob. In a tennis match, we basically break down the points into three general categories. The first category we call regular points, and those are the points at the beginning of the game. So love 15, 15 all. And the second category is pivotal points, where one player has 30 and the other player has love or 15. And the third category is called critical or crucial points. And those points either have the reward of finishing the game for you or your opponent, or at deuce, where it gets you close to that scoring opportunity to finish the game. So we play different kinds of tennis with different tactics and strategies within these categories. In regular points, because of the lower consequence of winning or losing the points, we play with more freedom and more creativity, not showing any specific patterns necessarily to our opponent, but mixing it up and doing things while you're still feeling out your opponent. In the pivotal points, you now start to play with either much higher percentage when you are at 30 love or 30 15. You do not take unnecessary chances. You do not think that you can just play a loose point and give a point away. You have to play without errors, and you have to make the other player really earn winning those points. And this is because if you win at 30 love or 30 15, whether you're serving or not, you now go to critical points, which are the highest chance of scoring in the game. So you go to 40 love or you go to 40 15. And thus you also will have a 40 30 point. So you'll have three game points right in a row possibly. And this should translate into a higher rate of success when it comes to winning the games. So Bob and I are looking at this, trying to make a simple way of choosing how to play and what to do in these different situations so that you're not just trying to pull things out of the air and hope they work.
Yeah, so with that, I think it's important that everyone starts to understand that when the score is very imbalanced, like let's say you're serving to me at love 40, okay? At that moment, I'm going to be taking a high level of risk on that particular return of serve, because even if I don't get it, I've still got two more break points coming against you. So when the score is imbalanced, the point value, the importance is actually lower. Another example would be, let's say I jumped ahead of you 5 love in the first set. At that point, I can play with quite a bit more freedom because of the cushion that I've established in the set. So as the score becomes less close, the points become less important. And it allows a creative player to do more different things on the court to bother his opponent. Now, Craig O'Shaughnessy has a language he uses to talk about this. He's the brain game tennis guy, and he's very good. He talks about during those pivotal and crucial moments, Scott, using what he calls a primary play, and during the regular moments that you could possibly be throwing in your secondary play. So why don't we go back for a second and you share with us an actual example of you're in the middle of a match now and you're facing your first pivotal moment. It's singles. What type of play would you be likely to run?
So in this situation, it matters whether you have the 30 love or the 30 15, or you're on the other side of it. And also whether you're receiving or serving. And it's important for a player to know what their strengths and weaknesses are, because those are the tools that you will use in these situations to implement your strategy. If I am serving at 15 30, on a fast court, I will want to maximize the use of my first serve so that I can get my opponent at least neutralized or on the defensive. And I may follow up to the net after my serve so that I can make a good first volley and put them under pressure right away, because I don't want to go down 15-40, because now that becomes a critical situation against me. So I will up the pressure a little bit there when it comes to when I'm serving at 15-30. Let's say I'm receiving at 15-30. Let's say I'm the receiver in that situation. So it's 30-15 for me, the receiver. And now I am not going to take an unnecessary risk. If the guy hits a serve and it's a second serve and he doesn't do much with it, I might take it and go to the net. But what I will not do, number one, is make careless, unforced errors. And I will keep him neutralized. I won't throw a lollipop into his big forehand if that's what he has. I might hit good slices to the backhand and just keep him neutral. I want him to have to play the point out and hit a bunch of balls. And if I have a chance to get aggressive and go in, put more pressure, then it makes sense to do that, but not until you build on a rock solid beginning to that game.
Okay, so I have one of my favorite examples of how a top pro. When we're saying running a secondary play, we may be adjusting the target we're hitting to, or we may be adjusting the pace that we're hitting with in order to throw our opponent off. And this particular example was from the year-end tournament in London a couple of years ago, where Roger Federer was playing David Ferrer. And it was a tight first set. Ferrer gave everyone trouble. It was 5-all. He was serving, but Federer had him 15-40 and a second serve. And what Federer elected to do there was, because he knows he has to be on offense, I think, against Ferrer most of the time to be successful, he went for his return with his forehand. He hit a bullet, but he chose down the middle. And he happened to miss the shot by 2 inches just out. Ferrer got the point. But I want to contrast that choice with the first game of the second set. Federer went on to break Ferrer, by the way, on that next point, in which he had Ferrer again, first game of the second set, 15-40 second serve. And this time he took his forehand and he ripped it cross court right near the line for a winner. And the simple reason that his target changed there was that the point importance, even though he missed the first one, he was going for a more conservative target. He knew even if he hit just what he wanted, Ferrer would get his racket on the ball. This other one where the point was worth quite a bit less, he took more risk and he was successful. He broke right away and then he ran away with the second set. So to me, that's a really great example of how pros use the point importance to adjust their targets to get the most out of their game.
That's a great example, Bob. And I think that our viewers can now begin to watch matches and see some of these tactical maneuvers and changes forming right before their eyes, because they can begin to have a better understanding of what the risk benefit ratio is at a given time. And that's basically what we're trying to get across here by categorizing the points and then having ideas about how you would play within certain parameters tactically during those points.
Yeah, so I'd like again to give a couple of examples. I mean, the score where it's so obvious that the point is not worth that much is at 40 love or love 40. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about when I was receiving serve in either of those two cases. I would almost every time take that return of serve and hit a hard drive right down the line at the net player. The goal, of course, was to win the point, but I was doing several other things at the same time. I was telling that net player, "You're not moving around on me." I was possibly intimidating the net player, like, "Uh-oh, here comes another hard shot at me. I hope I'm ready," type of thing. But also, I used this play in coaching one of my pros who was playing quite a bit of 8-0 mixed doubles. He was a very good 4-5. But he came to me and said, "You know, Bob, I'm not having that much fun playing 8-0 because I feel so constrained. I'm afraid to miss a shot because an unforced error from me, and it could turn the whole match around because my partner is trying as hard as she can, but she's making a few too many unforced errors. I don't feel like I could miss." So I encouraged him when he got the 40 love situation on either end of it to go for his shot. And basically he was making an investment in the freedom of his swing, not in winning the point. Well, he reported back to me the next week, said, "I was a different player. I took those lopsided score moments and I invested in my freedom to make a shot. I never got tight in this match. It was one of the best 8-0 matches I've ever played. Thank you so much." But what he was doing, what he started to do, was our theme of the day. He was playing to the score and using it to create freedom for himself.
Yeah, very good example. I have one also that I think our viewers can appreciate. While playing in the 35 and over National Grass Courts Championships in Southampton.
Was that last year, Scott?
No, just a couple of years ago.
Oh, couple, okay.
I played a player who was very well known from the Midwest, Neil Newman, who had like two knee braces on, two elbow braces on, and looked like he couldn't even like walk onto the court. Well, we're on this very fast grass surface, which, you know, I tended to play, you know, quite well on because I'm a big serve and volleyer and can hit big returns and things. But I found myself down 5-2 in the third set to this guy who you had to put blinders on, because if you looked at him with all the accoutrements on his body, you know, you would get distracted and think, how could I lose to this guy? Well, he was a really great player and pretty highly ranked. What did I do at down 5-2? Well, I just turned up the dial and I played with abandon, similar to what Bob had helped his student do in terms of freeing himself up to play with more freedom. I now was free to kind of do whatever I wanted because I had nothing to lose. Everybody watching the match and probably Neil Newman thought, okay, more or less, it's on grass. I have this match in the bag. Well, I won the match 7-5. I did not lose another game. And the way I did it is what's important. I heightened my concentration because now everything was crucial. One game and I was going to the doubles. So I played with better focus, higher concentration, and I attacked on every ball that was reasonable to attack. And I completely turned the momentum of the match around to the point where, well, I didn't lose another game. So I must have broken him like, what, three times there to go to win the match. Mm-hmm. And break and serve on grass, not the easiest thing to do. So if I had just tried to play regular tennis and without a real plan, and again, without that heightened concentration, because of how the score was, the results certainly could have been much different.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, one thing I see among some of my students, and maybe some of you out there can relate to this, is that when you have a good opponent down, you have to expect that they're going to throw caution to the wind, like Scott did, because a high quality opponent's just not going to just whimper and
lay down.
They're going to throw the kitchen sink at you the way Scott did. But I would also claim that one of the things that allowed Scott to be successful in this situation was that when he was down 5-2, remember what I was saying before, the further apart the score is, the less pressure there is because the points are less important. He actually freed himself up, to my way of thinking, because there was less pressure. There was a part of him which said, I'm probably going to lose this match, so just go for it and loosen up and do it. And then he was able, the thing that happens though, is when it gets back to 5-5, that's when you can tighten up again, because now it's like, oh my gosh, I could actually win this. So maybe, Scott, you can tell us a little bit, if you can remember back that far, it was many years ago, but if you could tell us, you know, what was that like when it got back to 5-all?
Right, so that's a syndrome, I think, that's repeated constantly in matches and even at the highest levels. And you, at 5-2, you play like you have nothing to lose, so you're loose, and you're concentrating and you're playing very well. At the same time, your opponent may be thinking, well, I have this match in the bag and I should win this match. And that kind of thinking may create tension or a lack of focus, just hoping that, you know, I'm going to, you know, give the match away or not play well enough to make such a big comeback. So there is a dichotomy there that occurs. And very often, just like Bob said, at that point at 5-2. So when I got to 5-all, the key was not to think about winning the set or, oh, now I can win the set. Whereas before at 5-2 and 5-3 and 5-4, I was just trying to stay in the match. I would specifically control my thought pattern not to think, oh, I could win the match now, because knowing as an experienced player that this could create excess tension and distraction, I kept playing the same way that I had been playing, aggressively, no errors, and with complete purpose. So what you should know as a viewer is in these situations, there's a difference between making winning important and having that in your mind during the match, as opposed to playing to win and having that as the focus in your mind. And that will guide you in terms of playing every point and not worried about, oh, I can win the match, or no, I'm going to lose the match. Oh, I'm down 5-2. I'm not going to be able to come back. Or I'm up 5-2. The other guy could never come back. All of those superfluous thoughts can sabotage your performance in those. And those are pretty critical situations, because it was at 5-2. There was no wiggle room for me to be off and make errors or, you know, fall down in my game plan.
Right. Well, congratulations again on that win. That was, I played Newman myself. I think the listeners should also know he also wore a back brace. You didn't mention that. And he was a psychiatrist. So part of this seemed to me anyway that he was sort of putting us on, that he had all these ailments. He was actually probably fine, given the way he moved and
well, Bob, I'm glad you mentioned it, because I had no idea. But my doubles partner, Kirk Moritz, after the match was over, who knew him very well. Mm-hmm. And I said something to him, and Kirk says, oh my God, Scott, that was such a great comeback. This guy is, you know, really a good player. And I said, yeah, but what about all these knee braces and elbows and everything? And maybe the back brace, I forgot about that, you know? And he says, it's all prophylactic. He doesn't have any injuries. This is all preventative. And I'm like, oh my God, that's just unbelievable. So a great tennis story there about what can affect your mind and the mental side of tennis on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, so I just want to redirect slightly our conversation, because there's another important area of playing a match that relates to me to playing to the score and point importance, and that's the very start of a match. If to your point now, if someone comes out and says, I have to win this match, and their focus is on winning, when the match is starting, you're going to tend to play too tight. You're going to tend to play with fear. And that's not the way to get things started. It's important to notice in the overall context of what we've been talking about, at the start of the match, let's say the first three games or so, the points have relatively little value, even when we're getting to deuce or add in or add out, compared to much later in the match. So this is a good time to use Paul Anacone's phrase. It's a good time to invest in hitting the ball the way you'd like to hit it. But given that we're also a little nervous, that's part of what happens when you go out to play at the start of a match. I recommend the following: that you hit a lot of good three-quarter speed first serves to get the first serve in, that when the other player is serving, you hit a good solid return, but you aim the ball down the middle of the court so you're not giving away unforced errors. If you start a match like this in a solid fashion and you get your racket speed going at the level that you want, even if you've fallen behind by a bit, you've invested in your ability to play tennis the way you want to play. So for the rest of the match, you can access your best tennis. The other thing you're doing by making a lot of shots at the start, they're good shots, but not great shots. You're getting information on your opponent. If you come out and you spray the ball around, you hit two double faults, two aces, you haven't learned anything whatsoever about how, if it gets to crunch time, are you going to take this opponent down? So for a couple of important reasons there, starting the match the right way, it's all informed by the importance of the point and how you can use that to invest in the rest of the match.
Let me add something there, Bob, that you usually put into this conversation, is that that's a time of not only investing in the match, but it's because you're collecting information that you will be using, not only as that set gets to be a little bit more down the line, but in the second set for sure. And then if you're in a third set, you've collected an awful lot of information by that time, or at least you should have, so that you can make the best decisions in terms of how to play at different points in the game and different games in the set, which we haven't really talked about yet, or when you go to play in a tiebreaker, because these things become crucial in terms of you maximizing your chance of winning the match. I'll remember one little example. I played Alex Diaz, who played for Auburn and was number one in the country in the 35 and over rankings in the USTA going back. And I was in a third set with him, and, or no, we were playing doubles actually against he and his partner, Jacob Kramer. They're both from Brazil. And I served the first point of the tiebreaker wide to his forehand, and it was probably the biggest mistake of my life.
Mm.
Because even though he would like make a few errors here and there against on that serve, if it was good enough, he would also hit winners. And I went over there and gave him a chance to hit a winner to start that tiebreaker off. And boom, that really set the tone. And it was a very big mistake tactically. I should have been serving that ball at the tee up the middle and giving us a chance to pick off the return, or at least be able to hit the first volley and get into the point. But nope, I had to go wide there and try to catch him. And boy, did he punish me. So these are the things that you should really know. And I did kind of know it. And then I just made a bad choice there for some reason. And you're collecting that information so you can use it intelligently at these other crucial times in the match. And you'll win more matches if you're making those better decisions based on what you've been seeing throughout your match.
Yeah. Yeah, that is. I know you're a big believer in center theory. So the fact that you went out wide there, I don't know, you may have been smoking something there or something that made you make a choice like that. I'm not sure.
Not till later.
I think at this point, we need to sort of wrap it up for today. And I appreciate your thoughts and points that you've helped me to make here for the listeners. I think they have a much better idea now of the relative value of points and how it affects their decision-making before they'd start playing a point at any moment in the match. And I'd just like to finish up by pointing out that in most tennis matches played, about 80 to 90% of the points are of very little value compared to the others. They're significantly below those crucial point values. So if you can appreciate that as a player, I think it should help to free you up to play a more relaxed and go for it style tennis.
Yeah, and just to help summarize on these three categories, when you have a regular point, you can play with more freedom and more creativity. Again, playing percentage tennis, but not being so strict in terms of your choices. Then when you have pivotal points, you need to play much closer to the straight percentage tennis rules that critical points. You need to up the concentration and play with more aggressive tactics because the reward
Hi, all. I apologize, Scott and I apologize. We had some technical difficulties there, but I do want to summarize what we hope you were able to come away with from today's session. The first one is just general guidelines for understanding when points are worth a lot more than others, and being able to use that to run your primary plays when the points are more important and your secondary plays when they're not as important. So let me just give another example of running a primary play. For example, the other team goes both back against you in doubles, and your primary play is to hit a good approach shot right down the middle of the court, draw them together so they have no angles to work with, and then look to finish to the outside once you pulled them to the center of the court. Now, in my drills, I often play games up to 11, and it's almost an exact mirror of what is a super tiebreaker, which is obviously up to 10. And one thing I'm really trying to make all of my players aware of is they should be staying in touch with primary versus secondary play while they're doing this drill, in addition to working on their skills. So for example, if a team were to go up 6-1, so there's a large gap in the score, if they want to take a time there and run a couple of secondary plays by attacking out wide or hitting a drop shot approach, that's fine with me, because they're using that cushion to make the opponents even more uncomfortable. But once the score would be something like 8-all, 9-all, I must see them using their primary play, attacking down the middle of the court as a way to set up the point and close out the game to 11. Now, another thing we talked about, just to review it, was how at the start of a match, the points are not worth very much. Eric Budarek spoke at a seminar last year in which he was one of the top doubles players in the world a couple of years ago, in which he went over in his first return game as a returner, what was he doing as a returner? And he basically said something like this: I hit one lob, I hit one good cross court, and I hit one down the line. In other words, he's coming out to create uncertainty using that first game of the match. He's not so concerned about trying to win it as he is to create uncertainty for the rest of the match as to what type of return his opponents are going to have to deal with. That is a part of how to use points of low importance to create the atmosphere you want that can lead to victory. I hope you'll all subscribe so you have easy access to our next podcast. And Scott and I'm speaking for him now as he's off with the technical difficulties. Hope to see you again very soon. Thank you.